began to descend rapidly, and they guessed that it must actually be heading toward the Withywindle Valley, not at all the direction they wished to take. After some discussion, they decided to leave this misleading path and strike northward, for although they hadn't been able to see it from the hilltop, the road must lie that way, and it couldn't be many miles off. Also northward, and to the left of the path, the land seemed to be drier and more open, climbing up to slopes where the trees were thinner, and pines and firs replaced the oaks and ashes and other strange and nameless trees of the denser wood. At first their choice seemed to be good. They got along at a fair speed, though whenever they got a glimpse of the sun in an open glade, they seemed unaccountably to have veered eastwards. But after a time the trees began to close in again, just where they had appeared from a distance to be thinner and less tangled. Then deep folds in the ground were discovered unexpectedly, like the ruts of great giant wheels or wide moats and sunken roads long disused and choked with brambles. These lay usually right across their line of march, and could only be crossed by scrambling down and out again, which was troublesome and difficult with their ponies. Each time they climbed down, they found the hollow filled with thick bushes and matted undergrowth, which somehow wouldn't yield to the left, but only gave way when they turned to the right, and they had to go some distance along the bottom before they could find a way up the further bank. Each time they clambered out, the trees seemed deeper and darker, and always to the left and upwards it was most difficult to find a way, and they were forced to the right and downwards. After an hour or two they had lost all clear sense of direction, though they knew well enough that they'd long ceased to go northward at all. They were headed off, and were simply following a course chosen for them, eastwards and southwards, into the heart of the forest, and not out of it. The afternoon was wearing away when they scrambled and stumbled into a fold that was wider and deeper than any they had yet met. It was so steep and overhung that it proved impossible to climb out of it again, either forwards or backwards, without leaving their ponies and their baggage behind. All they could do was to follow the fold, downwards. The ground grew soft, and in places boggy. Springs appeared in the banks, and soon they found themselves following a brook that trickled and babbled through a weedy bed. Then the ground began to fall rapidly, and the brook, growing strong and noisy, flowed and leaped swiftly downhill. They were in a deep, dim-lit gully, overarched by trees high above them. After stumbling along for some way along the stream, they came quite suddenly out of the gloom. As if through a gate, they saw the sunlight before them. Coming to the opening, they found that they had made their way down through a cleft in a high, steep bank, almost a cliff. At its feet was a wide space of grass and reeds, and in the distance could be glimpsed another bank almost as steep. A golden afternoon of late sunshine lay warm and drowsy upon the hidden land between. In the midst of it, there wound lazily a dark river of brown water, bordered with ancient willows, arched over with willows, blocked with fallen willows, and flecked with thousands of faded willow leaves. The air was thick with them, fluttering yellow from the branches, for there was a warm and gentle breeze blowing softly in the valley, and the reeds were rustling, and the willow boughs were creaking. "Well, now I have at least some notion of where we are," said Mary. "We've come almost in the opposite direction to which we intended. This is the River Withywindle. I'll go on and explore." He passed out into the sunshine and disappeared into the long grasses. After a while he reappeared, and reported that there was fairly solid ground between the cliff foot and the river. In some places firm turf went down to the water's edge. "What's more," he said, "there seems to be something like a footpath winding along on this side of the river. If we turn left and follow it, we shall be bound to come out on the east side of the forest eventually." "I dare say," said Pippin. "That is, if the track goes on so far, and doesn't simply lead us into a bog and leave us there. Who made the track, do you suppose, and why? I'm sure it wasn't for our benefit. I'm getting very suspicious of this forest and everything in it, and I begin to believe all the stories about it. And have you any idea how far eastward we should have to go?" "No," said Mary, "I haven't. I don't know in the least how far down the Withywindle we are, or who could possibly come here often enough to make a path along it. But there's no other way out that I can see or think of." There being nothing else for it, they filed out, and Mary led them to the path that he'd discovered. Everywhere the reeds and grasses were lush and tall, in places far above their heads, but once found, the path was easy to follow, as it turned and twisted, picking out the sounder ground among the bogs and pools. Here and there it passed over other rills, running down gullies into the Withywindle out of the higher forest lands, and at these points there were tree trunks or bundles of brushwood laid carefully across. The hobbits began to feel very hot. There were armies of flies of all kinds buzzing round their ears, and the afternoon sun was burning on their backs. At last they came suddenly into a thin shade. Great grey branches reached across the path. Each step forward became more reluctant than the last. Sleepiness seemed to be creeping out of the ground and up their legs and falling softly out of the air upon their heads and eyes. Frodo felt his chin go down and his head nod. Just in front of him, Pippin fell forward onto his knees. Frodo halted. "It's no good," he heard Merry saying. "Can't go on another step without rest. Must have nap. It's cool under the willows. Less flies." Frodo didn't like the sound of this. "Come on," he cried. "We can't have a nap yet. We must get clear of the forest first." But the others were too far gone to care. Beside them, Sam stood yawning and blinking stupidly. Suddenly Frodo himself felt sleep overwhelming him. His head swam. There now seemed hardly a sound in the air. The flies had stopped buzzing. Only a gentle noise on the edge of hearing, a soft fluttering, as of a song half-whispered, seemed to stir in the boughs above. He lifted his heavy eyes and saw leaning over him a huge willow tree, old and hoary. Enormous it looked, its sprawling branches going up like reaching arms with many long-fingered hands, its knotted and twisted trunk gaping in wide fissures that creaked faintly as the boughs moved. The leaves fluttering against the bright sky dazzled him, and he toppled over, lying where he fell upon the grass. Merry and Pippin dragged themselves forward and laid down with their backs to the willow trunk. Behind them the great cracks gaped wide to receive them as the tree swayed and creaked. They looked up at the grey and yellow leaves, moving softly against the light and singing. They shut their eyes, and then it seemed that they could almost hear words, cool words, saying something about water and sleep. They gave themselves up to the spell and fell fast asleep at the foot of the great grey willow. Frodo lay for a while, fighting with the sleep that was overpowering him. Then, with an effort, he struggled to his feet again. He felt a compelling desire for cool water. "Wait for me, Sam," he stammered. "Must bathe feet a minute." Half in a dream, he wandered forward to the riverward side of the tree, where great winding roots grew out into the stream, like gnarled dragonets straining down to drink. He straddled one of these, and paddled his hot feet in the cool brown water, and there he too suddenly fell asleep with his back against the tree. Sam sat down and scratched his head and yawned like a cavern. He was worried. The afternoon was getting late, and he thought this sudden sleepiness uncanny. "There's more behind this than sun and warm air," he muttered to himself. "I don't like this great big tree. I don't trust it. Hark at it singing about sleep now. This won't do at all." He pulled himself to his feet and staggered off to see what had become of the ponies. He found that two had wandered on a good way along the path, and he'd just caught them and brought them back toward the others when he heard two noises, one loud and the other soft but very clear. One was a splash of something heavy falling into the water. The other was a noise like the snick of a lock when a door quietly closes fast. He rushed back to the bank. Frodo was in the water close to the edge, and a great tree root seemed to be over him and holding him down, but he was not struggling. Sam gripped him by the jacket and dragged him from under the root, and then with difficulty hauled him onto the bank. Almost at once he woke and coughed and spluttered. "Do you know, Sam," he said at length, "the beastly tree threw me in. I felt it. The big root just twisted round and tipped me in."
"You were dreaming, I expect, Mr. Frodo," said Sam. "You shouldn't sit in such a place if you feel sleepy."
"What about the others?" Frodo asked. "I wonder what sort of dreams they're having." They went round to the other side of the tree, and then Sam understood the click that he had heard. Pippin had vanished. The crack by which he had laid himself had closed together so that not a chink could be seen. Merry was trapped. Another crack had closed about his waist. His legs lay outside, but the rest of him was inside a dark opening, the edges of which gripped like a pair of pincers. Frodo and Sam beat first upon the tree trunk where Pippin had lain. Then they struggled frantically to pull open the jaws of the crack that held poor Merry. It was quite useless.
"What a foul thing to happen!" cried Frodo wildly. "Why did we ever come into this dreadful forest? I wish we were all back at Trick Hollow." He kicked the tree with all his strength, heedless of his own feet. A hardly perceptible shiver ran through the stem and up into the branches. The leaves rustled and whispered, but with the sound now of faint and far-off laughter.
"I suppose we haven't got an axe among our luggage, Mr. Frodo," said Sam.
"I brought a little hatchet for chopping firewood," said Frodo. "That wouldn't be much use."
"Wait a minute," cried Sam, struck by an idea suggested by firewood. "We might do something with fire."
"We might," said Frodo doubtfully. "We might succeed in roasting Pippin alive inside."
"We might try to hurt or frighten this tree to begin with," said Sam fiercely. "If it don't let them go, I'll have it down if I have to gnaw it."
He ran to the ponies and before long came back with two tinder boxes and a hatchet. Quickly they gathered dry grass and leaves and bits of bark and made a pile of broken twigs and chopped sticks. These they heaped against the trunk on the far side of the tree from the prisoners. As soon as Sam had struck a spark into the tinder, it kindled the dry grass and a flurry of flame and smoke went up. The twigs crackled. Little fingers of fire licked against the dry, scored rind of the ancient tree and scorched it. A tremor ran through the whole willow. The leaves seemed to hiss above their heads with a sound of pain and anger. A loud scream came from Merry, and from far inside the tree they heard Pippin give a muffled yell.
"Put it out! Put it out!" cried Merry. "He'll squeeze me in too if you don't. He says so."
"Who? What?"
shouted Frodo, rushing round to the other side of the tree.
"Put it out! Put it out!" begged Merry.
The branches of the willow began to sway violently. There was a sound as of a wind rising and spreading outwards to the branches of all the other trees round about, as though they had dropped a stone into the quiet slumber of the river valley and set up ripples of anger that ran out over the whole forest. Sam kicked at the little fire and stamped out the sparks, but Frodo, without any clear idea of why he did so or what he hoped for, ran along the path crying, "Help! Help! Help!" It seemed to him that he could hardly hear the sound of his own shrill voice. It was blown away from him by the willow wind and drowned in a clamour of leaves as soon as the words left his mouth. He felt desperate, lost and witless. Suddenly he stopped. There was an answer, or so he thought, but it seemed to come from behind him, away down the path further back in the forest. He turned round and listened, and soon there could be no doubt. Someone was singing a song. A deep, glad voice was singing carelessly and happily, but it was singing nonsense.
"Hey, doll, merry doll, ring-a-dong, dillo, ring-a-dong, hop along, fell the willow, tom-bom, jolly tom, tom-bombadillo."
Half hopeful and half afraid of some new danger, Frodo and Sam now both stood still. Suddenly, out of a long string of nonsense words, or so they seemed, the voice rose up loud and clear and burst into this song.
Hey, come a merry doll, dairy doll, my darling. Light goes the weather wind and the feathered starling. Down along under hill, shining in the sunlight, waiting on the doorstep for the cold starlight. There my pretty lady is, river woman's daughter, slender as a willow wand, clearer than the water. Old Tom Bombadil, water lilies bringing, comes hopping home again. Can you hear him singing? Hey, come, merry doll, dilly doll and merry-o, goldberry, goldberry, merry yellow berry-o. Poor old willow man, you tuck your roots away. Tom's in a hurry now, evening will follow day. Tom's going home again, water lilies bringing. Hey, come, dairy doll, can you hear me singing?
Frodo and Sam stood as if enchanted. The wind puffed out. The leaves hung silently again on stiff branches. There was another burst of song, and then suddenly, hopping and dancing along the path, there appeared above the reeds an old battered hat with a tall crown and a long blue feather stuck in the band. With another hop and a bound, there came into view a man, or so it seemed. At any rate, he was too large and heavy for a hobbit, if not quite tall enough for one of the big people, though he made noise enough for one, stumping along with great yellow boots on his thick legs and charging through grass and rushes like a cow going down to drink. He had a blue coat and a long brown beard. His eyes were blue and bright, and his face was red as a ripe apple, but creased with 100 wrinkles of laughter. In his hands he carried on a large leaf, as on a tray, a small pile of white water lilies.
"Help!"
cried Frodo and Sam, running towards him with their hands stretched out.
"Whoa, whoa, steady there!"
cried the old man, holding up one hand, and they stopped short, as if they had been struck stiff.
"Now, my little fellows, where be you a-going to, puffing like a bellows? What's the matter here, then? Do you know who I am? I'm Tom Bombadil. Tell me what's your trouble? Tom's in a hurry now. Don't you crush my lilies."
"My friends are caught in the willow tree," cried Frodo, breathless. "Master Merry's been squeezed in a crack," cried Sam.
"What?" shouted Tom Bombadil, leaping up in the air. "Old man Willow? Not worse than that, eh? That can soon be mended. I know the tune for him, old grey willow man. I'll freeze his marrow cold if he don't behave himself. I'll sing his roots off. I'll sing a wind up and blow leaf and branch away. Old man Willow."
Setting down his lilies carefully on the grass, he ran to the tree. There he saw Merry's feet still sticking out. The rest had already been drawn further inside. Tom put his mouth to the crack and began singing into it in a low voice. They could not catch the words, but evidently Merry was aroused. His legs began to kick. Tom sprang away, and breaking off a hanging branch, smote the side of the willow with it.
"You'll let them out again, old man Willow," he said. "What be you a-thinking of? You should not be waking. Eat earth, dig deep, drink water, go to sleep. Bombadil is talking."
He then seized Merry's feet and drew him out of the suddenly widening crack. There was a tearing creak, and the other crack split open, and out of it Pippin sprang, as if he had been kicked. Then, with a loud snap, both cracks closed fast again. A shudder ran through the tree from root to tip, and complete silence fell.
"Thank you," said the hobbits, one after the other.
Tom Bombadil burst out laughing.
"Well, my little fellows," said he, stooping so that he peered into their faces, "you shall come home with me. The table is all laden with yellow cream, honeycomb, and white bread and butter. Goldberry is waiting. Time enough for questions around the supper table. You follow after me as quick as you are able."
With that he picked up his lilies, and then with a beckoning wave of his hand went hopping and dancing along the path eastward, still singing loudly and nonsensically. Too surprised and too relieved to talk, the hobbits followed after him as fast as they could. But that was not fast enough. Tom soon disappeared in front of them, and the noise of his singing got fainter and further away. Suddenly his voice came floating back to them in a loud halloo.
Up along, my little friends, up the weary windle. Tom's going on ahead, candles for to kindle.